to Bellwether Friends. Definitely not the first podcast featuring a discussion of pop culture and why we think you should like what we like. You should trust us because we're librarians. I'm Anna and I like to organize books.
I'm Aline and I like to get rid of books.
Fair. Every couple of weeks, we'll get together and chat about a pop culture topic or two, what we think and how we feel. We'll end the show with our current obsessions. This is episode number 69.
How appropriate! Today, as our guest, we have Kelly Maher, author of DC set contemporary hot romances. And she's not going to talk about them with us, but she will tell us about them. Hi, Kelly. Thanks for coming.
Thank you so, so much for having me, guys.
Kelly, you're also a secret librarian.
I am.
She's secretly a famous librarian, and if you don't know her, then you should. So, right, because we are librarians talking about pop culture, we sometimes have authors, but you have a better chance of being on as an author guest if you are also a librarian.
Right?
See also Kelly Jones.
And maybe also named Kellys.
Right. All the Kellys, all the librarians.
I don't know if we can find any more Kelly author librarians.
If you know any Kelly author librarians, be sure to tweet at us and we'll see if we can get them to be a guest. So today we are going to talk about true crime television, if we can get it together over here. We like to talk...
just like romance.
It's exactly like romance. Often, there is a romance at the core of the true crime television show. And
There is.
So, Kelly, would you tell us how you define true crime television for the purposes of our conversation today?
I would describe it as profiles of real life cases, usually interviewing the investigators of the crimes, very often the victims or family members of victims of the crimes, and a good 3/4, 95% of the time, inclusions of dramatizations of what possibly happened, and also usually actual police footage of the investigations, depending on the show.
Oh my God, the dramatizations. I have so much to say on this topic. So first, tell us a little bit about your history with true crime television. Like, when did you start watching it? When did you first become aware of it? That sort of thing. And then we'll do the same for ourselves.
Okay. Well, I like to say, in all truth, not necessarily all seriousness, but all truth, that my undergrad degree is in how to hide the bodies, because it is. It is in forensic anthropology, and I also minored in geology. So in hiding the bodies, that's a really good combination of degrees to have.
It really is. So you would be like better than bones.
Yes. Well, actually, you know what is funny is that when I was in undergrad, I had a particular instructor for 5 semesters, and she came into class one semester ranting and raving about how you do not sell your first work of fiction ever, let alone for a hardcover deal. Kathy Reichs had just announced the deal to the forensic anthropologist. So my instructor then turned to me, because she knew what a huge fiction reader I was, and said, "You had better write one of those one day."
Okay.
It stuck with me, and about the following summer break, I was in a very, very quiet data entry job and started writing. So that's how I got started writing, was directly due to forensic anthropology. And right around that same time was when The New Detective started as a TV show. And when I was in college, we actually had cable, which we did not have at my home. And so I'm like, oh, hey, here's the classes I'm studying. Oh, I know that. I know exactly what PCR is. I know this. I know that. And yeah, I don't need to see dead bodies anymore, at least especially the burned ones. I had seen enough of real life pictures of those. So I got hooked, because those were the classes I was taking. And at that time, I really wanted to work for the FBI as an evidence technician. And it just ended up not happening because I suck at math and therefore was not allowed to take chemistry. But it just hit me at just the right formative time. And I didn't watch a whole lot of stuff beyond New Detectives, FBI Files. And when I would go to hotels, I stumbled across Forensic Files on Headline News Network. And so that kept me going. And then when my family finally did get satellite TV, because it was not cable, thank you, this old house, and right. Not phone on PBS, that's how we got that. I found Discovery Channel, and they would periodically show a lot of the reruns of a lot of the same shows I had been watching. And then they slowly developed their own series of shows, and then grew to be so popular that they created a whole new network just for those shows. So it just has slowly evolved. And my latest obsession, which once again I stumbled across while in a hotel room, was American Greed on CNBC. So you don't usually expect to find a true crime show on a business network, but hey.
Well, it's about business people.
Well, and we're going to come back to American Greed, because that is the show that we watched as a basis for our conversation.
To get a flavor.
Because as we will soon learn, we have a novice among us. And it seems like you and I don't have a ton of overlap, Kelly. I started, I think this happened in my adulthood, somewhere between the time I left home and the time I started visiting home as an adult. There was about a 10-year span. Once my parents got me out of college, they retired.
They left the country.
They left the country. They took off on their sailboat. And so we lived on opposite sides of the planet for about 8 years. And then when I was, around in my early 30s, we reconvened in the same quadrant of the universe, and I could visit them at weekends and things from my life. And somewhere in there, my mom began to watch these true crime shows. And I think that they might have had really great ones when she was in New Zealand and Australia, because I think that's where she picked it up. And then in the U.S., this would have been in the early aughts, she was watching 24 Hours and Dateline and America's Most Wanted and those sorts of things, which are also chock full of reenactments and interviews with the investigators and interviews with the cousin's friend who ran into the guy at the store one night and just knew what was going on. And they are deeply, deeply troubling and kind of fascinating. I was always, I don't know if my mom was into this or not. It seemed like all the ones we watched, Dateline and 24 Hours and such, were some dude who was like a black widower and getting all the money from a series of ladies. Or he was just a not healthy mentally person who was going along living a normal life and then just cracked and everything went awry. And so I'm used to these stories. And so every time I'm reading anything in the newspaper, I'm like, oh yeah, the husband did it. And so I have that baseline sort of experience. And my mom still watches them. Anna and I were visiting her in April. And the first time Anna ever visited, we watched one a couple years back. And but when we were visiting in April, it was also sort of like, oh, what's on TV? Well, at 10 o'clock, this comes on. And so it's really easy to doze off while my mom is watching.
Yep. Well, the other thing that just made me realize, because I do periodically watch like Dateline and all of that. But it's like what I find is that more often than not, for some reason with those, I will go and look up the newspaper reports on those particular crimes to find out what the hell is going on. I'm like, okay, I'm done. Which is really weird that it's like those don't seem to hold me necessarily for the whole hour the way other shows do. What made me think of it is that Bill Curtis does a lot of, in Curtis Productions, does a lot of various true crime shows. Bill Curtis was one of my local anchormen when I was growing up in Chicago.
Oh, so, really?
Yes. And so it was like, oh, hey, Bill Curtis. And so I think that might have been another in for me. Was,
I need to see more.
Yeah. It's like if he was somebody that we trusted in our family, and he was a very trusted newsman throughout Chicago. And so he did a lot of these various true crime shows like Cold Case Files and a couple. I should know because I just have seen a couple recently, because now that I cut the cord even before I moved to DC and don't have cable, but in the last year and a half, there are now 2 over-the-air broadcast channels in DC that are for true crime shows.
Wow.
Yeah. And so because it's over-the-air broadcast, their budgets aren't so big. They usually get syndicated, really old run of the shows. But I'm like, oh, hey, Bill Curtis, how are you? And this is about 20 years old, so you're probably not doing so great.
Well, and I can totally relate to that, because, you know, there's a newscaster that you saw regularly at some point in your life. Maybe it's the one you grew up with. Maybe it's this one or that one. And you see them, if there might be a cameo in a movie that is set in that city or something, or they have like a second career
as
something.
You're talking about, what's his name again, aren't you?
No, I'm not talking about Pat Kiernan from New York One. I would never dream of talking about Pat Kiernan of New York One.
I'm always talking about him.
With, like, Ghostbusters?
Yes! Oh my gosh, it made me so happy. I think I squealed in the theater. But you see that stuff, and that's another access point. It's sort of like, oh, hey, this guy's voice, or this guy's whatever. And but I'm really looking forward to hearing about Anna's history with true crime television.
Well, it should be brief. I think I've been in the room with various people when they're watching true crime programming. We didn't have cable at my house, but when I went to college, I watched almost exclusively MTV.
Of course you did.
Instead of anything else. I remember knowing that America's Most Wanted was on, and I've heard of this was on Dateline, or X was on Dateline, and I'm sure I've seen a segment or two, but the first time I could pinpoint watching one of those shows all the way through and paying attention was last night as we prepared for this episode.
Oh my gosh, really?
Yeah. However, I have been listening to a podcast from previously.tv called The Blotter Presents, which is Sarah from Extra Hot Great sort of spun this off of that podcast. And if you're interested in true crime stuff and you want to get started, they only have like 19 or 20 episodes, and so it's manageable backlist. And what they do is they take on a couple of true crime properties, a movie or a TV episode or a miniseries, and they talk about like how it did with the case and whether you should bother watching it or not. And it's very enjoyable. So my true crime experience is both books and TV is limited, but I recommend The Blotter Presents.
We'll link to that in the show notes. Do we want to move on to the episode that we watched?
Yeah, we'll just talk about the episode. So Kelly suggested that we watch American Greed Season 7, and the episode is entitled Prisoner of Wall Street, which was about this con artist named Perry Griggs, who, when the action opens, it is revealed that he has been running a commodity scam from prison, and that people have been giving him money. It's a lot more complicated than that, and so they decide to go back in time. But it essentially, all of these people are caught in a Ponzi scheme, not only in the current day story, but in the backstory as well.
Yeah. He's got the crime thing that he's imprisoned for, and he starts afresh with a whole new thing that this is what's going on. I am really missing the boat on it. Kelly, what are we leaving out?
Honestly, what first comment, I think the first time I saw this episode was, again, I was in a hotel room. I watch a lot of TV when I'm in hotel rooms.
Don't we all?
Yep.
The thing that really struck me was the FBI agent who was investigating the refinancing scheme, Ponzi scheme, because yeah, I swear to God, 95% of the crimes on American Greed end up being some form of a Ponzi scheme, just be prepared. And so Tom Simon, who is the agent in Honolulu, the FBI agent, the thing that stuck with me was he was describing how Harry and his wife, Rochelle, had disappeared, and they were searching for them because they had left Hawaii, or Rochelle had left. I forget if Harry had ever been to Hawaii or not, but they did not show up for their court date. And so they were searching. Yes, Harry had been there. He was indicted, and they were supposed to show up for their court date. They did not show, and the FBI went searching for them. As part of the search, and like how they got off the island is very holy cow, but when they went searching, it came up somehow that there was this Craigslist posting that they had somewhat tracked to being Harry. And Tom Simon's response to this was, by the way, I'm going to get this wrong, but it's so close. I've got this really great investigative technique that I'm going to share with you. I Googled it.
Oh my gosh. Now there are some librarian skills at work right there.
Right? That's what I thought. I was like, he could be a librarian. Good job, Agent Simon.
And it was like being a librarian. I was like, I fell for it at that point. I'm like, yes, I love this episode. But what happened was, originally, Harry set up a commodities Ponzi scheme it was partially a Ponzi scheme, and then he was also essentially check kiting through one of his victims. He said, okay, I'll give you $250,000 for this investment to cover you. But by the way, can you give me like $70,000, a check for $70,000? I need to go to Vegas.
To do this thing.
Right. And so the guy gave him $70,000, a check for $70,000, and he got the money and went off. And then he went to deposit the check for $250,000 and discovered it was not right. So between all of that and the other investments, commodities investments, Perry got sent off to federal prison and basically bribed the guards and a few other things. And one of the things that they note is in this particular prison at that particular time, there were a lot of other prisoners who were of Native Hawaiian descent and or ties to Hawaii. And so he like lived this elaborate lifestyle like in prison, where he was like smoking cigars, getting like high money investor
magazines. That was my favorite detail.
I know. He got his wife, who I can't remember if she was a preacher's daughter or I know she went with her mom on a ministry visit, which is how they met. So,
how romantic.
Yeah. And so he got her to go out to Hawaii.
Yeah, so that's key to remember, that he hooked up with his wife when he was doing his time previously in the clink. She was like one of those Good Samaritan prison visitors.
Right. And so that's another thing that I've gotten out of American Greed. Be careful when somebody comes to you with religion and money.
Oh, boy.
Those don't mix well. So Rochelle, the wife, she went out to Hawaii and basically befriended a number of people, because one of the things that they also make a point of is that in Hawaii, a lot of the islanders don't necessarily have a lot of cash on hand, but if their families have been in Hawaii for a very long time, they've likely owned the land, which is a very valuable thing. And so two of the victims that were interviewed and profiled as part of this episode were actually sisters. You don't realize that at first, but they are. One sister, she and her husband saved up through the years and bought land that her family had originally owned. Oh. And the other sister, she and her husband also owned their house. And basically they were convinced to, even though they owned their houses free and clear, they were convinced in order to invest in this scheme. And I have a feeling that it was presented as, hey, this is going to do some good, but we'll get a return of like $20,000 in 10 years and they'll pay the mortgage as part of the scheme, which this is at least the third episode with this kind of scheme.
I'm sorry. It's not funny, but if you've watched a bunch of these, then you know that the dude has always killed his wife, and the very nice people who met the con artist at church are going to get taken for everything they're worth, and so on.
Yeah, and sometimes it's the church. There's been a few of those. What happened with the scheme eventually falling apart is, as with all Ponzi schemes, is that you are unable to bring in enough money to cover your previous debts, of the debts of to your previous investors. And so Agent Simon said at the very beginning of the episode, he says, hey, I started getting these calls from Hawaiians who are, their houses are in foreclosure and they don't know what's going on. And I talked with them and they said that this was an investment opportunity was being run by somebody in federal prison. And he's like, excuse me, what? And so Rochelle and Perry eventually recruited somebody who lived on the islands to assist them in their scheme because she was visiting, I believe, her husband in the same prison that Perry was in. So again, those tentacles from prison reaching out, meeting people at their place of worship, because not Nani Faye, I forget the other sister's name, but she talked about how Rochelle would meet with her and call her auntie. It was just, you could see how taken in she was by the good manners, the willingness to pray with them, because at least both these sisters were very honestly spiritual and religious. And so that's where I think a lot of people get taken in, when they take their faith seriously and truly, when others are good at portraying that idea as well. And so it's really hard. You want to have faith in people, and when it's, because this I think went on for a number of years too before it started falling apart. It's Ponzi schemes, again, from years of watching American Greed, they can usually last for a number of years. And I think the longest one that I saw was like almost 20 something years.
Oh my goodness. Just
really long for a Ponzi scheme. I want to say it's usually 3 to 5 years at most that they will last. So, but yeah, it was, unfortunately, Nani Faye, her husband, died in the course of this after it was discovered that they might lose their home through foreclosure. And so that is an honestly stressful thing when it's like you believe that you're investing for your children's and grandchildren's future, and now you're going to lose your house because somebody cheated you out of it. Yeah. So there's something about the way American Greed presents the victims, and that it's very respectful of them. And I think that's one of the reasons why I like it, other than the fact that Stacey Keach narrates. So
now you have to tell me who Stacey Keach is in this.
Oh my gosh, it's Mike Hammer. You don't remember Mike Hammer?
No.
Oh, for heaven's sake. Okay. Kelly, do you have a better than that primer on Stacey Keach?
Yeah, I didn't remember my camera, and I'm the same age as Nana.
This is true.
Fine.
He was Two and a Half Men, Charlie's fiance, almost wife's dad, who hooked up with his best friend from the Navy.
Nope. But that makes me happy.
Right, yes.
Right. I feel really bad that I can't remember who.
That's all right. I can look it up.
Yes. That I think if you saw him, you might recognize him.
I think I recognize his voice as, like,
he had a giant mustache.
Oh. Yes.
Is he still alive?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, but maybe his mustache isn't.
Who knows? It's so hard
this
to
is
say.
A good, this is a good way to open up my series of questions.
Oh, you have questions for us?
My series of... Well, first I have to start off with a pet peeve.
Okay.
And I also want to say that the appeal is mysterious to me, but I don't feel that the fact that I am still figuring out the appeal means that it's not worth watching.
How diplomatic of you.
But I hate, and this goes for documentaries of all shapes and sizes, I hate when they talk about things that happened in the past. In the present tense.
Okay.
So I can't watch without being like, why are they doing that? Why are they doing that? Why did they do this? That did this or did this not happen years ago? Is it happening right now? No, it's not happening right now.
Okay.
So that's the thing. But I did enjoy the couple of reenactments that we got in this, one of which was loving video shots of floors being refurbished. Because originally one of these guys' early schemes was like something to do with flooring, and then another loving series of stock footage of people in fancy watches and wearing fancy jewelry.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna throw it to you for reenactments.
So this is a thing that has always been my least favorite aspect of it. I would be more interested in still shots with voiceover of a mugshot or a newspaper article or the site of some incident. And in the 90s and aughts, this was a particular affliction of these true crime stories and also the History Channel, where they had live footage of medieval battles and ancient Roman households and so on. And it is just something that just bugs the tar out of me. And I don't know what it is about the falsehood. I can tolerate a little bit better the stock footage factor than I can with, you know, vaguely resembling actors performing what is presented as the scene of the crime where the person gets killed or they get talked into the scheme or whatever.
So I like the stock footage because I found stock footage entertaining. And I think I've seen reenactments where I've been like, well, that's at least someone is getting paid for having to reenact these things, right?
Yeah, okay. Glad to employ actors, some faceless, some simply resembling murderous killers.
Do you think it's better to have reenactments or to just have like a whole like made-for-TV movie that's about JonBenet and has tiny JonBenet actress?
I think it depends because there's some shows that I've seen that the reenactments range from not bothering me to like, okay, I'm good with this. And then there's others that I'm like, I can't stop, please, now, please. and those would be the ones that would probably be better as I almost said as seen on TV. I'm like, no, this is but one of those made for TV movies, because it is just that level of soapiness.
Right.
I think I prefer reenactments, which are not done for dramatic soapiness of telling the story. So as they're done to be as factual as possible to present the information in an entertaining way, but again, no soapiness.
I can understand having a reenactment if it's hard to visualize the thing that they're talking about.
Yeah, you make a really good point with it, and I can understand that as being a reason for the reenactment. I think that you really hit it on the head, Kelly, with the soapiness versus, you know, presenting a difficult-to-visualize situation. And maybe I'll be looking for that.
Well, you know what? One that I like, that I find it's more towards presenting information, but can hear a tiny bit into soapiness, is Deadly Women.
Gosh, what? Deadly Women?
Yes, there is at least 7, if not like 8 or 9 seasons, Investigation Discovery, also on Hulu.
We will be checking into the Deadly Women.
Okay.
Candace DeLong, she's in a lot of them. In fact, I think she was probably the lead presenter of that. But the thing about Deadly Women to keep in mind is that it is almost solely reenactment, which you'll recognize the number of the actors from episode to episode, by the way. I've looked them up, and they have IMDb pages. This is another interesting thing, Aline, that they have 2 to 3 cases presented per show, and I want to say at least half of them are filled in Australia and New Zealand.
Hey!
Yeah, and some of them are not from Australia and New Zealand, even though there are a lot of those as well. But they also do historical. So,
okay.
Yes, and it's usually one contemporary and one historical. And actually, this kind of brings something up. So for the day job, I work with books, and I have to write annotations for the books. And one of the books that I just annotated was Before We Were Yours by Lisa Wingate. And that is a fictionalized story based on a true crime story, which is the Tennessee Children's Home story that came to light in the 1950s. Basically, children all across the southeastern U.S. were kidnapped by a woman and her network. The woman was called, her name was Georgia Tan. And so that was the basis for this book by Lisa Wingate. I've seen her profiled on Deadly Women. I've seen her profiled on Unsolved Mysteries. And there's other places. Yes, that's another good one. But Lisa Wingate, in her author's note at the end, specifically referenced Deadly Women, Unsolved Mysteries, and another true crime show that I can't remember for helping provide more background information that she could further research about this case.
Nice.
You will see, if you go from show to show to show, you will often see the same case presented in many different ways depending on what the focus of the show is.
That is something that The Blotter Presents does sometimes. They'll take a case and they'll look at two different shows or movies about it and talk about both of them, which I appreciate. I think I like hearing other people talk about what they liked about or didn't like about the show rather than watching the show. My main discomfort watching this particular episode of American Greed was that it was hard to watch those people talk about, you know, losing all their money in the house their grandfather owned and, like, thinking about all of the white people that probably want to buy land in Hawaii that has been owned by Hawaiian families for generations, and, like, there not being any way that they're ever going to get their money back.
Right. Yeah. And that's one of the things that when I was trying to think of an episode to suggest, which why it took me weeks to get back to you on that, just trying to think of a show and an episode where it wasn't, I didn't want to be exploitative of people's pain, because a lot of these shows showcase people's pain, and I feel uncomfortable when I feel like their pain is being exploited for entertainment, because that's a very fine line and depends on the person when watching true crime shows like this, because you are essentially seeing people's pain, especially when victims and victims' family members are being interviewed about this. And I think that's another appeal point for me, that it depends on the show, is how respectful they are of those victims and how they present them. And very often, the ones that really stick with me are victims who are like, this happened to me and it really, really, really sucked. And this is the pain I feel, but I want somebody to either learn from my mistakes, which is usually what American Greed is, or it is, I want injustice. I want the world to know about my loved one and know that this should not have happened to them, but my loved one existed, and I don't want their memory to be erased.
I think you hit on something with that, with the treating the victims with respect, because while we were shouting at the television, why are you giving him money? What about this doesn't smell bad to you? They did not present the victims as ignorant in any way. They presented the victims as, you know, earnest people wanting good for their families, which is legitimate. The first set of crimes they were talking about, which is not his first, Perry Gibbs's first
Griggs,
set of crimes.
Sorry,
Griggs, not Gibbs. I'm thinking NCIS, and that's Jethro. So he was in jail when he met his wife in Washington State. Thank you very much. I've ridden my bike past that prison. And so he meets his wife, and then he gets out, and they start living this life in posh California and playing golf. And that set of victims...
It was easier to not be sympathetic.
It was easier to not be sympathetic. Now, the show presented this set of white fat cats trying to make more money out of money they had. They were also respectful of these guys. We were not in our home, but that's pretty par for the course around here. But, like, the one guy you were talking about, he's like, oh, well, I'll give you this check for $250,000, and I need you to hold on to it for 10 days. By the way, I need $50,000 to run to Vegas this weekend. We were like, are you kidding me? through the whole thing. But there was not a sort of prurient, oh, how stupid or ignorant thing going on. We had difficulty wrapping our minds around falling in with somebody when I'm like, there are these vast organizations that are like set up to take care of your money and to take care of your investments. And it's not going to have that fast return that you're looking for, but it's a whole heck of a lot safer.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I've had an IRA forever. And
do you they, know, so this airs on CNBC.
Yes.
Does Prudential buy ad space for American Greed?
I don't know.
Yeah, I watch it on Hulu or Escape, which is one of the over-the-air broadcasts. So on the over-the-air, I get, hey, if you've had this medical device implanted, you might have a claim against the company.
Right, right.
Right, and I don't remember what the Hulu adverts were because we were still talking about the show during the adverts.
Right.
Sorry, Hulu, you need to work on your advertisements being more interesting.
So I appreciated the sympathy for the victims.
Yeah.
But I also didn't understand. So every time they showed a picture of Perry Griggs, he was wearing an AC/DC t-shirt or a logo t-shirt that looked like the cheapest possible t-shirt. And I was like, how is it that the Fat Cats ever gave him any money? Because he does not, I mean, even though they had the high-flying lifestyle, he
right.
did not present as someone with whom they might be comfortable trusting their money. I was like, okay, if you want to be duped, carry on.
And that was the thing I found so interesting. The one guy, he's like, he was on the golf course all the time, so I figured he retired early. I'm like, oh my God.
Right?
That means yeah. he doesn't have a job, but it doesn't mean he retired.
Yeah, that guy. Oh well, guy. He was so mad. He was like, let's see. He was standing behind his wife the entire time, is what I wrote down.
Right, when they were yelling at the door.
Like, who does that? Who stands yeah. behind their wife?
Right. Guys who end up on American Greed.
Right. And just a lot of people saying, I think he was more sorry for getting caught than for ruining anyone's life. That,
right.
I mean, that is the moral of the story, I do believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's like I've seen episodes where they talk about how the person who perpetrated the crime actually shows remorse and feels bad for what they did and the impact, especially after victim statements are being read. But then you have the people like Perry Griggs who are like, yeah, I needed money to spend in Vegas, so what else was I supposed to do? So
now he's in like super solitary, not allowed. Not allowed to talk to the, he's like an X-Files guy who can persuade people with his voice, and so he has to be locked away.
And that's interesting. You've got the con men who are, they know that's their calling, is to be con men, and they're really good at talking their victims into doing whatever they want. And then you've got the people who kind of fall into the con, at least the ones on American Greed, where they may start out legitimately, and then they expand into areas that they probably shouldn't be expanding into and don't know how to dig themselves out, and then just keep digging even further. So, like, there was this one that I just watched the other day who I forget his first name. His last name is Juan. He's in Arizona. And he had a very prominent real estate business that he, I remember... Everybody was like, if you passed a highway real estate sign, it was Vaughn's face there. And so he was just a very prominent business figure. And when you have a reputation that's very solid, that's built up, it's really easy to pull people in when you veer off the straight and narrow because you have that solid reputation behind you. And that's the other thing. A lot of victims of Ponzi schemes don't know that they're a victim until the checks stop cashing.
Right.
And it usually happens all at once. I remember with the Vaughn case, everybody's like, the one guy who was profiled, one of the victims, was like, for 19 years, my check cashed every month. So he's like, what red flag is there? This is somebody who grew his business that around the same time my family grew our business. My dad trusted him. I trusted him. Everybody in town trusted him because he had this really solid reputation. And then it was just all at once, he couldn't pull in enough money to be able to pay his previous debtors, investors. I think that's the thing that it just, it's really interesting. There's another American Greed episode where it's because insurance fraud is another popular.
I bet it is. Oh boy.
So, yeah. And there's this one episode where I think the guy is based in Kansas City area, and they basically sold car repair insurance. So if you see those commercials on TV, I give them the side eye all the time after this episode.
We were talking about how people come into the library all the time with whatever miracle deal that they're looking to cash in on, and they want us to help them get online and, like, help them fill out paperwork that will give away all of their personal information.
Right, exactly. Because wire transfer and wire fraud is very often how many of these people are charged with crimes. That's the other thing, is that people, they're willfully blind. And a number of the victims throughout the episodes have said, it's like, yeah, this guy was greedy and took all my money and all these other people's money, but I fell into it because I was greedy too.
Right.
I want that money. And so when you're playing off of somebody's desire, especially here in America, where it's the American dream to become rich overnight, it's really hard when that's culturally driven into you and baked into you. It's really hard to get somebody to wake up when they have chosen to buy into, no, I trust this person because of whatever reason, I'm going to make it. And because this, why would this person hurt me in this way? They can't imagine it for whatever reason.
Yeah.
I think that was the end of my notes, although I also liked Agent Simon's Google trick.
We loved Agent Simon.
That's not the only episode he's in. He's in at least one other one, too, and I had trouble. I'm like, which one is where he says Google? What's that one?
So which one is it?
Yeah, and so you know who he actually reminded me of?
Agent Coulson? No.
No. Trey Gowdy. Trey Gowdy had been on Cold Case File or something back when he was a prosecutor. And the way he presented himself for whatever show that was, because I'm totally blanking on it, it's been so long, but it's that very engaging, nerdy presentation.
Yeah, he was very nerdy.
But he was super engaging. It's exactly engaging nerdy.
Mm-hmm.
Good job.
And also kind of like the face shape also reminded me. But I don't know if they are just that way naturally or if they've had media training where to present the information in an engaging way. Because like I said, Agent Simon has been on other episodes of American Greed. And you sometimes see, especially like on FBI files, you will frequently see the same agents who are being presented. And you wonder if that's not only because they worked on the cases or if they're also chosen because, oh, these guys are actually good on TV and they're not deadheads.
Right. So what else do we have?
Well, I was going to say, so you've heard our commentary on things that we like and don't like. Do you have, like, let's say I wanted to watch something else. Now that you know the depth of my non-knowledge about true crime shows, do you have some viewer's advisory for me?
I am trying to think because there are so many different ones. And you've been exposed to Dateline and other ones like that. FBI files can be interesting, but there is a lot of reenactment with that.
Well, that's fun for me. It's just Ellen doesn't like it.
I guess I could leave the room.
FBI files is interesting if you're at all interested in the FBI. I always like New Detectives is old, but one of the reasons why I like it is because it's very much focused on the science behind solving crimes. I actually just finished, right before I got on the call with you guys, I finished watching an episode of a show called Extreme Forensics, which is, I've never seen it except on Escape, so I don't know production-wise.
I like the name Extreme Forensics.
Yeah, that sounds fun.
So, and some other episodes, they talk about how it's like a single fiber helps solve the case type of thing.
Nice.
In this particular episode, they kind of knew who likely did the crime, but they had no direct evidence. that they could tie the person to the crime. And what happened was that they had bullets, bullet casings from the original crime. And then they had an informant who happened to be related to one of the suspects say, "Hey, I have this gun." And the guys were like, "All right, we're going to be over." And he's like, "Yeah, so I just sold it to my dealer."
Shoot.
Exactly. And so what happened is that that person that he sold it to ended up in a gang gunfight in another neighborhood of the city, which, again, it was about, as they said, 300 miles away from where the original crime happened. And they were able to tie the crime in Pittsburgh, which was gang-related violence, to the crime, which was a double homicide in Parsippany, New Jersey, in a hotel room. And it looked like a mob hit type of execution. And they tied it because they were able to get compare the bullets and bullet casings and say the same gun was used in both of these crimes. And so they were like, "Okay, so we know that little informant boy got the gun from one of our suspects. And so that is the only way that bullets from this crime that were shot out of a particular gun could have ended up at this gang crime." So circling back to the front, yes, it was a love triangle, and the wife did it.
Ah, okay.
So it was actually the wife's lover who did it, but still. Again, I'm pretty sure I've seen that particular crime profiled on other shows. But this particular focus was on, here's the science that we did to solve this crime and get the evidence that we needed to prosecute.
I do like science-y forensic show, like procedurals.
Yeah, well, and I was going to say that. I, separate from the true crime conversation that we're having, I am a huge fan of a crime procedural and the way crimes are solved. And following investigative procedures and science and research and
we
forensics.
We have talked about Patricia Cornwell on this show
before. Yeah, when you and Carolyn and Dolly talked about it in days of yore. And we might have to revisit it, okay, since we have all 20 seasons of Law and Order over there.
You do.
But I really, really like seeing the way the pieces come together. And I think that that's part of maybe my mom's interest in it, because she's been a mystery reader my whole life, and she likes to see the way things come together and the way crimes are solved. I don't want to think that my mom is just a bloodthirsty maniac, but she might be that as well. And I respect that. She's my mom. I love her. So I... But in terms of the viewer's advisory, I think that that sounds good, what Kelly's been telling us. And also, the Deadly Women thing, I'm all over the Deadly Women thing. As soon as we hang up here, I'm going to want to go find one.
Okay.
You know what? What's kind of off the beaten path, but something I really loved, it's not in production anymore because the host is dead. But
we added the sirens for atmosphere.
I know. I live on a major street. There is always a lot of
sirens. No, it's okay. It's okay.
It's awesome.
We usually have jingling cat bells.
Well, it's like I live by my apartment faces the driveway, so half the time sirens come up and pull up right outside my apartment.
Nice. So
let me look up the exact title. Dominic Dunn is the host, the author, and socialite, I guess you could call him, even though he was a guy. And Dominic Dunn.
Well, he has a book called Justice. Is this about the show?
I don't think it's necessarily about the show, but I'm sure he probably discussed it in one of his episodes. Let's see, producer herself. It's called Power, Privilege, and Justice. So okay. Dominic, Power, Privilege, and Justice. And he focuses on basically high society crimes and
okay. That
kind of stuff. So he was kind of almost like Truman Capote.
Right.
Admittedly, Truman Capote's claim to fame for true crime was In Cold Blood, which was a farmhouse in Kansas and drifters, but they lived in the same social stratosphere. So there's some crossover there. But yeah, so Dominic Dunn, I think, would be another kind of interesting one to see, because I like the kind of tweak on presenting it. And he was, a really good presenter. And again, respectful, I thought. And so then, of course, all of investigation discovery. But you have to be careful with that, because it's like I've tuned in like, "Oh, hey, new show," when I'm back at my parents' and have satellite TV. But they have kind of gone a little to the soapy end of things, because there's stuff like Wives with Knives. And
don't tempt her.
Sorry, that sounds awesome.
Yeah, and it's like, I can't remember some of the others. That one has like just stuck with me, because I'm like, you're seriously going there? How many cases are there Wives with Knives?
Oh, I bet there's a lot.
Yes. But yeah, Deadly Woman is, again, an older one, but one I really like. And let's see. And I find the commenters on Deadly Woman to be, again, respectful but entertaining. Like Candace DeLong, she's a regular. There's another one whose name I'm completely blanking on because I haven't watched it recently. And W. Michael Phelps, who is a true crime author.
Michael Phelps.
Right. And to meet him at Book Expo this year. So
nice.
Which one? The swimmer?
No, not the swimmer.
Okay.
I think we would have known if Michael Phelps was around.
Right.
Investigation Discovery is a really popular channel. There's also True TV. It's not all true crime, but it does a fair amount of true crime. I think, was it Lifetime? Or there's one other cable channel that does some fairly regular true crime programming, because I think they see the popularity of Investigation Discovery. And there is, I can't remember what the term is, but there is a internet term for people who watch Investigation Discovery all the time.
Uh-oh.
So, and I'm blanking on it, but you can probably find it.
I can imagine.
Yeah. There's a lot of options, but I think lately things have been going more towards the soapy end of things, so I will very often rewatch episodes of shows like American Greed and New Detectives, and Cold Case Files is another one. That's a Bill Curtis show, and that's also really good for procedural stuff to track how they developed, especially because they're all cold case files. So they talk about the initial investigation.
Right. I think they talked about that on The Blotter Presents.
Okay, yeah.
If you've been having trouble keeping up with all of these show titles, they will be in the show notes on our webpage.
Yes, so you don't have to write anything down.
And I'm just amazed I remember all of them myself.
That's why you're on as the expert.
Yep.
See?
Well, and this is something else I find interesting, because it's not viewing, but a few weeks, months ago, Smart Bitches, on their podcast, two of their regular reviewers talked about true crime podcasts that they listen to.
Ah.
A very popular podcast these days is My Favorite Murder.
Yep.
I've tried to listen to it because a lot of my friends listen to it. They're murderinos, and I like true crime. I actually didn't like it that much, and I think it was because of the way it was presented, where it's very conversational, very nice, but they say in the first episode that they're about more the storytelling rather than making sure that they're saying the facts correctly.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of, I think it goes back to what us as Reader's Advisors.
I was just saying, being a librarian, maybe.
Not only the fact aspect, but also the author voice, or in this case, podcaster voice and tone, and whether or not that appeals to reader, listener, viewer.
Mm-hmm.
And their voice, such as it is, did not quite appeal to me. It's like their actual voices are fine, but the voice of the show didn't really appeal to me. But on the opposite end of things, there's a podcast that's not true crime specific. It's called You Must Remember This. And they have a series that is on the Charlie Manson murders.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a 12 episode series. And it just really digs into the background in how Charlie Manson got to be where he was at, where Sharon Tate got to be where she was at, where Roman Polanski got to be where he was at, and just how all these various factors converged into one night of horror. And again, I thought it was very respectful of the victims. They did not do interviews, but she does reenactments.
Hmm.
Yeah, and I was not taken out listening to it, because I thought it was very well done.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, and so I was just really fascinated. So I really like to plug that particular series because of how much detail she really dug into. And I thought the way that they presented, because she talks about Jay Sebring, who is Sharon Tate's very good friend, and the other victims, and I think it was LaBianco, the other family that Charlie Manson's followers killed the night after Sharon Tate. And so I really loved the respect of the history that I'm totally blanking on her name, who does this, but it's the You Must Remember This podcast. So okay. You can search for the Charlie Manson series.
We'll link it.
There's a lot of discussion about why these appeal, especially in the Smart Bitches podcast, because it's very subjective, because like I said, I don't like soapy aspects to my true crime where others love that. Right. So yeah, so that can sometimes be hard to figure out with, all right, so what is that you like about it? Because people are like, I don't want to say I enjoy watching people's pain, because that's not exactly it. But
or maybe it is.
For some people, yes. But it's like, but usually they have trouble, I think, really pulling out of themselves why they are so fascinated with crime. And it's like, I can fall back on the fact that I'm like, I used to study this. This was going to be my career until I got derailed and went into a career of telling people where to go.
Right.
So there's a lot of fascinating stuff about true crime.
I agree.
There really is.
We appreciate your expertise.
Yeah. Do we have anything else we want to ask?
Do you mostly watch TV, or do you read the books also?
I actually mostly watch TV. This is the kind of funny thing, is that I mostly read fiction and mostly watch nonfiction.
Okay, that's interesting. So,
other than movies, I tend to be more of a nonfiction TV watcher.
Okay, I can see that.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. That seems reasonable. So, should we move on to our obsessions?
Yeah. Do we want to have Kelly tell us about her...
Yeah, first I want Kelly to tell us about her latest book or series.
All right, so my latest book is The Bridesmaid and the Hurricane, which is the first full-length novel in the Capital Kisses world. I did a short story back in January of 2016 called Blizzard Bliss that was written and set and published during the January 2016 blizzard in DC. And so I had a couple of people review it and say, hey, what about his sister? I'm like, I don't have a name for her. She was not on the page, so I don't know yet. And this is his sister. So Radhika is a television producer. Colm is a broadcast meteorologist. And they happen to have a one night or one weekend stand during the blizzard, and he is now her coworker. So she has to deal with the fact that he is a coworker that she thought she was never going to see again. And she also has a boss from hell having a meltdown during this time. And her friends are like, hey, you should totally hit that. You already hit it once. Go hit that again.
Thanks, friends.
Right, because he was recently named one of the hottest bachelors of the year, and the nickname that he was given was the Hurricane Hottie.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's Bridesmaid and the Hurricane. So they work out their issues, and it's a happy romance, but there's a lot of stuff that they have to work through. And I'm currently working on a novella that is going to star a very side character in that book, and then I will be writing the novel for one of Radhika's best friends, who is another bridesmaid. So it's a group of four friends who regularly go to brunch. So I call them mentally the Brunching Bridesmaids Trilogy.
Okay, great.
Nice.
We will have links to your places that people could find that.
We will, yeah. So, Kelly, do you have a musical obsession to share with us?
I've got a couple of musical obsessions. I created a playlist that I call Get the Beat Going that I use to focus both at day job work and then at homework with writing. And so it's filled with lots of different songs, but the two songs on it that I love listening to is Warriors by Imagine Dragons, because okay, that was in the Wonder Woman trailer before it came out. And the other is America's Sweetheart by L. King. And I just really love that, both both of those songs.
Excellent. We will add them to our Musical Obsessions playlist, provided they are on Spotify.
I think they should be.
Excellent. Anna, so what's your musical obsession?
So we spent a good chunk of time this last weekend listening to Kesha's new album.
Ooh.
So I'm guessing that our musical obsessions are going to be off the same record. I knew occasional Kesha songs, but I hadn't, like, sat down and listened to an album like this before.
And we were on the road this weekend. We were driving around doing things, and so we listened to this album probably 6 times in a row all the way through.
Which is not something I do that much anymore either. Usually I get stuck on one song, and I listen to that song over and over again. But we didn't do the album, like, A to Z because we were shuffle playing it due to Spotify reasons.
Thank you, Spotify.
So I'm not sure exactly how it hangs together as an album. There are a lot of songs I like off of it. There are a few things that I'm like, you're growing as a person. Maybe you can keep growing a little bit farther.
Be nice.
We're all progressing toward our ideal selves, right?
We are, yes.
So my song is Learn to Let Go, because I'm a sucker for a seize the day, let it go anthem, and that is what that song is.
Excellent. I like a whole lot of stuff on this album. I really enjoy Dolly Parton showing up in Old Flames, Can't Hold a Flame to You, which is a song candle. That Kesha's mother
wrote. Can't Hold a Candle to You.
Candle, whatever.
It's the pun.
Candle.
Come on.
Right. No, I get it. But, so, as I was saying, we learned from friend of the podcast and worst bestseller, Renata, that Kesha's mom wrote the song for Dolly Parton, and then Kesha covers it on her album, and Dolly sings it with her, which is just, like, heart-burstingly exciting for a young singer who knows that Dolly is awesome. And Kesha grew up in Nashville. Thank you, Renata, for all of this information.
Wait, is this your obsession, or are you just saying it?
She knows that it matters. I'm just talking about Kesha, and I'm not done yet, so you can just sit tight there, Missy.
You were the one that was hurrying me on.
So the album is chock full of songs designated as explicit on Spotify, and several of them I cannot fathom a radio edit for, and these, of course, are my favorites, but the song that I am putting on our Musical Obsessions playlist is Him, because it is, as she says in her NPR interview that we tweeted and will add to the show notes, it is a hymn for people who don't have religion. And it says a lot of inspiring things in a spiritually non-spiritual way that speaks to me like nobody's business.
I have some lyrics I want to quote.
Oh, quote lyrics from my musical obsession, Abby. Do, please.
I sure will, just as soon as I get my Google to work.
Okay.
Our internet is like, you want to stream Skype and do this? I don't think so.
Oh, I hate internet days like that.
There's the one she wants to quote. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Was that the one you were looking for?
You're not helping. Here we go. If we die before we wake, who we are is no mistake. This is just the way we're made.
Oh, Kesha.
Right.
There's also another one. 'Cause if there's a heaven, don't care if we get in. Thank you. So, you should go listen to the whole album on Spotify, because you can do that for free and find your own favorite new Kesha song. Kelly, do you have a regular obsession you would like to share?
It has been a while since I have blasted through a knitting pattern like I did the one that I finished binding off right before I got on the phone with you guys.
Congratulations and yay and high fives.
Thank you. Thank you. It is a shawl pattern called Black Death. Speaking of true crime.
Nice.
I would say it's about an intermediate level knitting pattern, and I got it off of Ravelry. I cannot remember if it is free or not, but I knit it up in this very nice for the knitters and crocheters out there, you will understand this reference. It is worsted / Aran weight yarn. So it's nice and relatively fat. So that means it knits up very quickly. It's from Dragonfly Fiberworks. It was their special colorway for the Maryland Sheep and Wool Festival that I went to in May. And so it was their Valkyrie yarn. Yay. And the color was Billy Goat Trail. So it was, it's just, I'm really excited to wear it on my trip to Scandinavia next week.
Woo!
That sounds absolutely wonderful. I know just enough about knitting to have followed what you were saying and be very excited about the project being done and the beauty of the yarn. And I'm looking forward to looking it up so that I can admire pictures of it.
Yes.
Because that sounds really awesome.
Anna, I'm a scarf aficionado myself.
You are a scarf aficionado, which a shawl is near.
Right.
Yep.
That's basically what happens when you take a scarf and you leave it alone for a while. I have a variety of obsessions, none of which are very translatable. I'm obsessed with rainbows. I'm still obsessed with cats. I mentioned I like organizing books. Right now I'm playing a phone game called Seeker's Notes,
which I like to call Seeker's Holes.
Right. It has a strange font that makes that plausible. And it just involves, it's like finding hidden objects in a scene, but the scenes are all vaguely threatening scenes from a town that has been invaded by nasty mystical creatures. And there's some kind of plot. I'm not sure exactly what's going on in the plot. It doesn't really matter.
It's kind of Victorian and there's a bosomy maid.
Yeah. So that's my latest gaming obsession.
Awesome.
Also rainbows.
Also rainbows, yes.
What about you?
All rainbows all the time. We share a rainbow obsession. I am sadly, sadly obsessed with Costco. So I have been a Costco member most of my adult life, and in my immediate past life, I used it as part of my regular marketing because there were products that were appropriate for my household. And in the last couple of years, I let my Costco membership lapse because we can't eat 2 pounds of cheese in a week because we just don't have that kind of endurance. I beg your pardon?
Some of us are dainty.
Some of us are dainty, yes. So I let my Costco membership lapse, and we've been without a Costco membership for a year and a half or so. And I have been missing some of the things. Like, food prices are really comparable at Trader Joe's, and for a normal-sized household, you just can shop at Trader Joe's, and that's great if you've got one nearby, which we do. And there are other things that you can only get at Costco and that are so totally worth it, and I cite the Kirkland wool socks that they have at this time of year that Anna wears and loves
all year round.
And she wears them year round because she has perpetually cold feet. And these are a Kirkland brand smart wool sock type that you get 4 pairs for the price of a pair of smart wool socks. And that alone is worth your membership for the year if you buy 1 4-pack of these socks.
Which we have.
Which we did on Saturday, and along with about $75 million worth of other stuff.
But the lure of Costco was such that we went there on the peak time Saturday afternoon with everyone else in the world.
We did.
We didn't want to kill each other.
No, yeah, we did pass that relationship test. And we got a Groupon so that it would be a discounted membership by way of various gift cards that they claim they will mail to us in 4 to 6 weeks.
Yeah, we'll see.
Which, we'll see how that works out. But one of them is a free pizza, and one of them is a gift card that we can go spend on more free pizzas or gift card pizzas or something. Anyway, we bought a whole bunch of crap. It was really lovely to be back at Costco buying socks and checking out the fleeces.
Just and immersing ourselves in capitalism.
Getting, what did we get? What was probably the most ridiculously giant thing? We got this container of ketchup. So you may know from us that Little G is a ketchupitarian and eats more ketchup than anything else. And so we got You know, they used to be those big cans, those big, like, food service cans. Now it comes in, like, a plastic thing with a screw top that is essentially a big food service can of ketchup. And we're going to give it to him for his birthday.
Yeah, so if you were a restaurant owner, you would want to buy your ketchup in this kind of bulk way so you could refill your ketchup dispenser things. But right. We're just giving it to a soon-to-be 8-year-old.
Right. We thought this would be a perfect 8th birthday present, and we hope you think so, too.
Okay, I have one more question I have to add in since you talked about the glory that is Costco.
Okay.
I have started watching QVC like a maniac.
Oh, no.
I have it on as background TV on a lot of days. Like, it's gotten so bad. I'm like, oh, it's noon on Sunday. I need to watch In the Kitchen with David. Oh, my God.
Oh, my God, indeed.
So, yeah, that's my other obsession lately. I'm turning into my aunt.
Wow.
Do you ever, like, text your aunt and say, are you seeing what's on QVC right now?
No, because she has been banned.
Okay,
I found out last time I was home, my mom was like, by the way, Kathy has been banned from QVC. She has returned too many items. I'm like, oh my God.
Okay.
That's amazing. I accidentally visited my favorites on Etsy this week.
Oh, why didn't you do that?
It was a moment of weakness, and I won't go back again, although I might update it. I want to delete a couple of things and make sure a couple of things are more prominently displayed in case anybody is shopping.
Are you looking at me?
No, I'm not looking at you.
Just wondering.
So, hey, I think we might have made it to the end.
Hey, I think we did make it to the end.
Oh my gosh, do we have a script?
We do have a script. I will even pull it up.
Awesome.
There are Kesha lyrics there right now.
Kesha lyrics are awesome.
Thanks for listening, is what it says on the script.
Great.
Which I'm going to read with my eyeballs.
Right now?
Yeah.
Awesome.
You can find us on Twitter at BellwetherFriends, BellwetherFrends. And wait a minute, we forgot to talk about Wish bestsellers.
Holy cats! Well, you can also find us on the latest episode. Maybe it's not the latest by the time this episode drops, but we were on a podcast sweeps week crossover event with our very dear friends, the Worst Bestsellers, yep, discussing the John Barrowman penned Dark Archer graphic novel, which is essentially
backstory,
arrow fic,
yeah,
and completely incomprehensible.
We can't recommend it.
We can't recommend it. No, yeah. We just can't. But we can recommend the podcast episode in which Anna, Renata, Kate, and I discuss it at length and in great detail.
We sure can.
So we will provide a link in the show notes and hope that you will catch it and subscribe to The Worst Bestsellers if you don't already. Because
Renata also did our astrological compatibility as a podcast with them. And we're very compatible. So.
Yes, we are super compatible. If you like us, you might like them. If you like them, you might like us. And it's all one big happy family. So, thank you for the reminder for us to get on that.
I knew I was forgetting something.
You want to finish the
script? That must have been while I was stalling.
Possibly.
You can find us on Facebook. We tumble occasionally. You can look us up on iTunes and leave us a review. You can find me online at Helga Grace, HELGAGRACE.
I'm Aline, and you can find me on Twitter at Surly Spice, SurlySpice. Kelly, where can we find you?
I'm on Twitter as at KMMAHER, because Kelly Maher was already taken. So, I am online. Website is Kelly, KellyMAHER.com. Thank you.
Excellent.
Thank you for joining us. Our in and out music was provided by Julie Jurgens. You can find her on Twitter at Hi Miss Julie, HIMISSJULIE.
Thanks again, Kelly.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great talking true crime with you guys.
Yay. Right? Bye.
Bye.
Bye.